Music has a special way of touching our hearts in ways many things cannot. And if you're tuning into this podcast, you probably think so too. On each episode of Classical Post, we uncover a creative mind behind music we find particularly exceptional. Coming to you from New York, Classical Post is created and produced by Gold Sound Media, a marketing and PR agency for the performing arts industry. I'm your host, Jonathan Eifert, creative director at Gold Sound Media. I hope you find something inspiring in this episode.
I'm Reggie Mobley. I am a countertenor based in the U.S., based in Boston, Massachusetts. Work mainly in Baroque music and contemporary music, as well as spirituals. Other than singing, I tend to do a lot in works for diversity and advocacy for arts.
Share the story behind one of your most significant performances.
I would say one of my most significant performances recently was an occasion where I not only sang, but I also curated and directed the concert. Before my life as a soloist in Baroque music and everything else, I spent a lot of time in the professional choral scene. One of the ensembles I sang with quite a bit was a group based in Miami, Florida, called Seraphic Fire. I basically cut my teeth with Seraphic Fire back when I was just an undergraduate. But recently I was brought back to lead my own concert. And the concert was one that I was able to build based on my own work and passion in advocacy and diversity. And it was a concert that was based around protest music. And so to dig back and create this concert that was based around the protest music of not just the US, but also the, you know, civil rights, also the queer rights movement and so many others was incredible. But the most impressive thing about that was, one, how well it was received in the state of Florida, a state of Florida that is headed by Ron DeSantis, but also that my family flew in to surprise me, which never, ever happens. I see my family maybe once every 2 or 3 years. And to have them see not just me sing, but see what I do and see what I'm passionate about in my life was a real pleasure. And I've done quite a few things. I've sung for kings, for sure. I've sung for pretty big people, but to impress your own mother, that's a hill that's difficult to climb.
Yeah, that's amazing. Discuss a pivotal moment in your career and how it influenced your musical direction.
Pivotal moment in my career, and everything kind of leads back to this, my issues of equity and diversity within the arts. And when I say diversity, I don't mean to conflate Black with diversity. I also mean female identifying. I mean queer. I mean, you know, brown and Asian as well. But there was a instance several years ago, maybe 7 years ago, where I was headed to a rehearsal and someone stopped me in the hall. And this is basically the story of my career. But I was stopped and asked to unlock a hall for a rehearsal that I was a part of. And I think I dealt with that enough at this point that it inspired me to ask everyone I could, every artist of color, to tell me their stories. And I kind of looked at this to make sure that I wasn't alone in this, but saw that something must be done. And as an artist, I composed a text. I commissioned composer to set this text and created a motet called Negro Sum, a fantasia on microaggressions that musically answered the issue of microaggressions and casual racism that is brooked upon every artist of color at some point in their career. And not just artists of color, but also the things that are said and done to female artists and queer artists as well. And from that point forward, I saw that not only was this the right thing to do, but that it gave me the inspiration to continue steering my career and what I do towards making art a safer place for people who should be able to just casually come into a space where they can feel comfortable and safe and experience joy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, what a crazy story. And how you use something, you know, bad or really annoying that was happening to you and unfortunate, and then made this incredible pivot out of it. Yeah, that's really amazing. And also the title, going just backtracking a little bit, the title, the microaggression part, that's really interesting that you chose that word. Any thoughts to illuminate that a little bit more?
Yeah, because this, no one is actually coming and saying, is no one says things outright. You know, the fact that a person can come up to you or come up to me and always say, man, I'm so sorry, I thought you were the janitor. Or say things like, hey, I left my thing here, can you go and get that for me? Or, you know, are you in the right place? I mean, all these things, these are microaggressions, these are casual racisms. No one is coming in with a white hood. No one's coming in with a lariat and intentionally singling me out as a Black person. No one is erasing my queerness by saying like, oh, you're this big, scary Black guy. You know, it's like, and to think that this voice comes out of you, like those things, those aren't kindnesses. Those aren't the things you say to a person. But they all file under the category of microaggressions because they are these little indignities that completely add up and create this heavy weight of emotional labor and baggage that we carry on stage and then have to shunt to try and entertain or move the very audiences of people who created that baggage in the first place. And this is something that everyone who lives and is represented by a minority group just simply deals with and don't always think about, but that weight is always there. Initially the title was going to be Death by a Thousand Microaggressions, but after hearing a Monteverdi Vespers and also coming across that passage in Song of Solomon in the Old Testament, I thought the way Negro assume, you know, I am Black is kind of understood and occasionally misunderstood, seemed like a much better title, and everything kind of followed from there.
Let's pause for a second. Are you an artist or work at an arts organization? I founded Gold Sound Media to help you expand your audience through social media. My team and I work closely with clients around the United States, directly shaping their messaging through customized strategic content. One of our biggest success stories is our work for the Clyburn, where we drove 25 million viewers, making it one of the most watched classical music events of all time. Get in touch to speak with me directly about how Gold Sound Media can help you. Just head to goldsoundmedia.com. Now, back to the show. So congrats on your upcoming concert tour with the Academy of Ancient Music. Tell us about the world premiere featured on the tour called From Ignatius Sancho, a new commission by composer Roderick Williams.
First of all, Roddy is an incredible composer and an unbelievable baritone. I mean, just getting him to agree to this was immediately just incredible. Like, it's the best thing ever. But it was great to include and commit, and that the AAAM agreed to commission this, because the idea behind the entire concert and the tour, Sons of England, is that it does focus on three types of British-born or British sons, you know, sons by birth. So like Sancho, I mean, Dowland and Purcell, you know, British-born expats. So British by choice, like Handel and Geminiani and many of the Europeans who chose to make London, to make England their home, but also British by circumstance or by force, which is, you know, the many Black Britons who were stolen from their home. You know, this is during, you know, the 18th century obviously is at the height of the slave trade. And England had many examples of slaves who earned their freedom, gained their freedom by some means, and excelled and created, you know, this backdrop of what will become the beginning of the Black British elite in England. And Sancho, of course, is an incredible story because, you know, born on a slave ship, you know, his mother and father both died. He was orphaned. And he was taken to England, sold to three sisters who did not want him to gain an education. They wanted him to remain as a docile, useful servant. But that was not the way things happened. He learned to read and write. He learned to compose and play. He gained his freedom. He became associated with the Duke of Montague. And then after his passing with the widow, where he was her butler for a while, but he became a shopkeeper. He gained his freedom that way. And he took a wife. And because he was a shopkeeper, he became the first person to vote in parliamentary elections in England. And not only that, but he became a part of the literati in the London area around that time. Like, everyone knew him. He was known by David Garrick and by Thomas Arne, I think, and Handel must have been aware of him as well. You know, he was a man of letters. I mean, he of all avenues of all disciplines of the arts, people know Ignacio Sancho. Like, as a musician, of course, I know of him through his music, but I've talked to visual artists who they think of him because of the Gainsborough portrait that he sat for. That's held in the National Gallery of Art in Toronto. I think it's currently still at the Royal Academy of Arts in London as part of the Entangled Past exhibition that's going on. But people in literature also know of him through his collected letters that basically became a textbook for the abolitionist movement in English-speaking countries, particularly in England. And so everyone knows of him, but to me, he's first and foremost, he's an incredible musician.
What a cool story. I mean, really amazing. And it's one of those characters in history, too, that had kind of this orbit of fame to some degree in their lifetime. And then for whatever reason over history, not everyone always remembers in terms of like the mass public. You know, like if we just say, for example, Handel, obviously people know Handel, but people might not know Sancho. So it's this interesting how like history unfolds. Do you have any comment about that sort of juxtaposition?
I always have comments. That's a never threat. I'm here to give. I think a lot about this, and I don't know how intended or how intentful it was, but there was, through the idea of canonization in music, there was a very, if not deliberate, a very present whitewashing and straightwashing of music, of the canon. We don't think of Schubert or Handel or Tchaikovsky, or even think too much about Roram as being queer composers. We don't think about these things. And we don't think about composers who were of color. We don't, you know, until recently, really until the George Floyd moment, where everyone realized that there was a huge lacking in our society, that no one was thinking about Florence Price or Chevalier Saint-Georges. No one was thinking about Sancho or Coleridge Taylor. And the fact that Western classical music in general, was not just created and furthered by, you know, 300-year-old bewigged straight white cis dudes there's so much more to it. The idea that even some of the music that we know and some of the instruments that we know didn't originate in Spain or Germany. And so it become important to me to try and bring some color and expansion and understanding to the canon through all of this. I think about this all the time because there's so much that's been forgotten and ignored over time through this kind of catering and curating this idea of what canon should be. It's the freebies, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. Like that's all there is. And very little filters off of that, but there is so much more that deserves to be known, especially now in a world that is so much more diverse than it was. And even if it is only marginally so, these groups have so much more voice and agency than we did in the past. And because of that, we have to respond to that. We have to accept that it was okay to, well, not that it was okay, but that we kind of allowed this canonization to happen and exist, because that's who we thought of as the general audience for classical music. But as our audiences are aging and dying out, and as the center of gravity of wealth and purchasing power has diversified, we as classical musicians, as artists, also have to respond to this, you know, in a way that we have to understand that our audiences are and must get darker. They must become more feminine. They must become more queer. We must look at the world as it is and respond, and not just show that the music of Bach is incredible, the music of Handel is incredible, but that the music of Sancho and Florence Price and Chevalier de Saint-Georges is also incredible. And not just that, but it proves that Black people didn't just start composing in 1920, but the fact that we've always had a seat at the table, it's just that someone else is sitting in it. To recognize that the arts, the classical music, and yes, the arts in general, has always been diverse. We've just spot focused on a subset, you know, are the very vocal majority, and ignored the rest that existed out there. And the time is now. The time is now to stop that focus and actually widen and look and see that everyone can be brought in, because everyone is represented. And so that's a long answer to your question.
How do you want to be remembered in the world of classical music? So when you think legacy, when you think legacy now, what do you think?
I don't care. I honestly don't care to be remembered. That's honestly not important to me. Legacy is not important to me. What's important to me is that whenever I stop singing, or whenever I move on from this world, that there are five more people who love Bach, who love music because of something that I participated in, that I've helped to maybe lay a ground that people that look like me, or that feel like me and love like me, feel more welcome and more acknowledged and have more onus and presence and representation in what we do. That this is not something that a Black kid or queer kid can come into as a flute, but that they've always known that, oh, I heard this fugue, I like classical music, then I'm going to do classical music. It's that's what I want. There don't need to be any statues of me. I don't even need my name to be anywhere after I go. I just hope that at some point after that what I've tried to do with my life continues. And that's basically it. I have no airs about that, no drugs about that whatsoever. I don't care.
So a different side of the coin, then, what does success mean to you? So not legacy, but just kind of in general, or just musically speaking, what does success mean to you?
Oh, success. I mean, it has several faces, honestly. In one aspect, I think I have gained that I am successful. I sing with the top, you know, symphonies in the U.S. I sing with the top, you know, Baroque organizations and period organizations in around the world. I get to do that as my day job, you know, and people do know my name. People do know who I am currently. I mean, I think that is success. Now, have I won any massive awards yet? No. Have I married any tall NBA players yet? Not yet. Those are other versions of success, but I think that's basically it. I think I've achieved that. I am doing what I want to do, and I know that what I think is important, I'm giving the platform and the agency to say and to sing, and I know that people are listening for now.
And last part of the podcast, it's a quick fire round. So I'm going to ask you a number of questions. And if you don't want to do it, just say next. But if so, just do it like, you know, super short answers.
All right.
So first one, what's a talent you have that would surprise our listeners?
Mixology.
If you could collaborate with any artist, dead or alive, who would it be?
Ella Fitzgerald.
If you could go back in time to witness any historical musical event, which one would you choose?
Any cantata performance on a regular Sunday in Leipzig, just to hear what Bach's choir sounded like.
What's your musical or non-musical guilty pleasure?
Japanese rap.
You are stranded on a desert island and can only take one piece of music with you. What would it be?
Matthew Passion.
If you weren't a musician, what profession would you be in?
A psychologist, therapist.
Which movie do you wish you could have composed the soundtrack for or performed on it?
Amadeus. I guess that would mean I'm Mozart.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Weather manipulation.
What's the first thing you do in the morning?
Pray.
Which city in the world inspires you the most?
Tokyo.
What book are you currently reading or would recommend?
I'm reading quite a few, but the book I'm reading right now is The Truth About Asexuality.
Which historical figure would you love to have dinner with?
Bach.
As a child, what did you dream of becoming?
An inventor.
What's your go-to comfort food?
Thai food.
Is there an unusual or rare instrument you'd love to learn to play?
Viola d'amore.
And then last question, what non-classical music or artists do you love and why?
Frank Sinatra. The chairman, he's unbelievable. His sense of just coolness and sprezzatura and just his general way and control and mastery of not just tone of rhythm, the way he plays with it is just unbelievable. I mean, the whole Rat Pack, honestly, but right now, this week, it's Frank.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Post. If you loved it, give us a 5-star review as it helps us reach more people. Also, remember to hit that follow button in your podcast app to get notified of new episodes.